creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
On this episode of Culture Click, we learn what to do in case of a shooting in a workplace or public space. Unfortunately, in today's society, we hear and see more media coverage of violence. Do you know what to do if you are caught in a threatening situation? Learn how to spot warning signs in individuals that could be a threat, how to defend yourself, and what to do after the fact. I'm Terry Tensett, and you're listening to Culture Click. You're listening to Culture Click, a very special edition where we're going to talk about active shooter. And I have Officer Eric Mueller from the Winona Police Department, also known as the Law Enforcement Center, with us to discuss it. We were hoping to catch your presentation you made in public, but we thought it might be better for you to come in and talk. Why don't you tell us what active shooter is?
Well, thanks for having me here again, Terry. It's always a good time to be here. Active shooter is just—it's very simple. It's an event where somebody comes in to a building, to an event, a social gathering, what have you, for whatever reason, and this basically just starts shooting. It's an ongoing, it's a very quick, dynamic event. Most of these events last no more than 7 minutes. There's not always a reason why. You know, we have like the shooting incident in Aurora, Colorado at the movie theater. You know, what drove that individual to pick that movie theater? Why did he shoot these people? Why did he choose to vent whatever he was trying to vent on these individuals? We in the law enforcement community have to kind of look at things a little bit more objectively in the, I don't really care why somebody is doing it. They are doing it. The after event autopsy of the shooter, the event itself, dissecting what happened, why it happened, and things like that fall on other experts. But as far as we are concerned in the police community, you know, we want to prevent the stuff from happening. We want to get the word out there like we're doing today as to what you can do as just a common citizen and a common employee at any place to kind of help prevent this from happening. Look for the warning signs. We will, you know, be happy to talk to you about the warning signs. There's just a lot of little things about it. It's not rocket science. Human beings have a natural fight or flight instinct, and that instinct is a very strong one. But there are some things that you can do in advance to kind of make sure that you have the best opportunity to survive these should they ever happen.
It could happen anywhere, right? It could happen at a person's home. It could happen at a business, or it can happen in a public shopping space, or let's say even at a park.
Absolutely. You know, one of the big classic terms that you hear now, it's become a little bit of a cliche in society. You hear people going postal. Mm-hmm. Well, that comes from the postal shootings. There have been, I believe, 22 postal shootings since like 1973. Probably the first big event that nobody really remembers. Some of us do that are old enough and you hate to date yourself. But, you know, in 1966... in Austin, Texas, you had Charles Whitman. That was a guy up in the clock tower. He went up there. So, you know, you kind of look at the look on your face and you kind of go, oh, wow, yeah, I remember that. But, you know, it was ancient history to a lot of younger people. But those of us that were alive back then do remember this. And, you know, I still remember seeing the video on TV. And nobody knows why this individual chose to go up to the top of this tower and just start randomly killing people. I mean, he killed 14 people. And, you know, the police had to learn some lessons from that because we were at a real disadvantage during that shooting. Most of the weaponry that the police were using at the time could not reach the level that Charles Whitman was on. He was finally stopped when some officers managed to break into the door at the top of the tower and shoot him. We try to learn from our mistakes. Society has to, or you end up repeating them. But if you look at other things, the bigger events that are in our recent history, Columbine, you know, it's 1999, Harrison Klebold, two seemingly average, normal kids, at least on the outside, go in and kill 12 people, wound, you know, dozens of others, shoot up a school, and basically started a phenomenon that is probably one of the most tragic things that we have. We have Sandy Hook following that. There's so many different schools that have followed then. Virginia Tech, from the college standpoint, that was horrendous. And we've had to learn from that, too. We have to learn some tactical differences. We have to learn to educate the schools into what they should be looking for on that. 32 people killed at Virginia Tech. And you try to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. That's the way I tend to look at a lot of things. And I mean, I could not even imagine trying to live through the horror of sitting in one of these large classrooms and have somebody walk in, the only way in to your classroom, block it, and proceed to start shooting. You know, we still have, you know, we have Jared Lautner in the Tucson, Arizona. Fortunately, he is, or however you want to look at it, he survived it, which is a very unusual instance. Most of them either have no intention of surviving. They go in and it's basically a suicide mission. And that's just alien to Western mentality. You just don't think of, you know, nobody's that sick in the head that they're going to run out there and do all this and then shoot themselves. But the vast majority do. And that's why law enforcement, the psychological community, people like that, doctors, nobody really has a way of doing much more than guessing as to what was going through these people's minds. It's a very, very tragic thing. You know, the Aurora, Colorado shooting, we mentioned that, you know, 12 people killed in the Sandy Hook in Newtown, Connecticut. You know, that was 2012, 27 children killed. People argue all the time, and I'm asked constantly about the big debate on weapons in society. Is it the gun's fault, or is it, you know, I certainly can't speak for all law enforcement, but I do know that as a law enforcement officer, we are out there. We deal with a tremendous amount of mental illness, and I tend to specialize a little bit in helping people who are mentally ill. I believe that that is something that is, thankfully, a very growing field, and it's a growing awareness in society and in law enforcement. This is going to sound a little cliche, but it's not the gun that is doing the killing. I have yet to see a gun that shoots on its own and kills somebody. It's somebody behind it. Thankfully, the overwhelming majority of lawful citizens out there who happen to have firearms have never any intention of doing anything like that. And, you know, the prevalence of firearms in our society is just something we have to live with. You know, we won't get into a big, deep philosophical debate on firearms, but they're here right now, and that is something that we need to deal with. They are legal, and as far as law enforcement is concerned, that, you know, we don't pass moral judgment on anything, but we have to deal with what we have at hand. You know, it's the mental illness that really seems to be, of the people who've survived, that we can look at and do psychological evaluations on. We can say that these people are suffering from a myriad of mental illnesses. At some point, what is the responsibility of society, and what avenues of society are established to try to help these people before this even happens?
There's warning signs, and there's being a good person and saying so-and-so needs help, but we have a tendency to live in a passive-aggressive society where we don't want to get involved, but probably we should. So if we wanted to talk about what those warning signs are and how to carefully approach that topic with the person you're concerned about.
You know, that's another question that I get asked at every presentation that I do. This is a scary topic, and I understand that because it's a big unknown. People start to go to work and they look at somebody who may be a little bit nervous or a little uneasy or somebody who happens to have a very volatile temper. And you think, oh my goodness, is this going to be the next person? Should I be worried about this? Well, the answer is probably not in most cases. People blow their stacks in various ways. People get angry. People vent. That's been going on for a long time. And, you know, your chances of being involved an active shooter situation are probably less than being hit by lightning. But the fact is lightning still hits and people still get hit by lightning. So therefore you still have to plan. You can't have a head in the sand. Let's just wait and see. It probably isn't going to happen to me attitude about this. Or if it does happen, you are going to be completely unprepared. And let's face it, when it happens, if it happens, and it's going to happen somewhere, somebody is going to be coming in. Somebody is going to be doing everything they can to end people's lives and cause as much destruction and mayhem as possible. And you want to try to minimize that. We want to try to minimize that in law enforcement. Some of the warning signs are, and these are not definites. So I always have people kind of look over at the person sitting next to them in these meetings and kind of wonder, could this be that person? Statistically, they're usually male. I don't know why. I guess we could get into the, maybe it's a testosterone thing or no clue, although not all of them. There was one of the first big postal incidents was actually a female who did that. They're usually loners. Klebold and Harris, who did the Columbine shooting, were very much loners, kind of what we would call on the fringe. of social society within their school, their high school. People are often bullied in the schools or in the workplace. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody who has ever been bullied or considers themselves having been bullied is going to go and shoot someplace or shoot up a place. But these are the findings after the event, when you go back and you start to talk to all the friends and the relatives, the schoolmates, find out what really happens. It seems that in most cases, the parents of the people who are doing this are actually the last to suspect that these people would do this. You know, as parents, we like to think that our children are all exceptional and that they're examples of ourselves. And we know that, you know, we ourselves would not want to do something like that. So, you know, my goodness, how could my child ever do this? That's not like him. There was never any warning signs. Well, yes, there was. When you talk to the friends and you talk to the other people who know these people on a different level, you find out that there's a lot of dark stuff that has a tendency to be going around on, you know, within their head. Very frequently, there's a lot of history of depression that will follow these people, kind of a sense of hopelessness. And again, you know, depression, you know, one out of probably every 10 people in society suffer from a form of depression. That is probably the most common form of mental illness. And people just think of it, well, gee, you know, you're depressed, take a happy pill, go eat some chocolate or something like that. Well, that's not what it's about. It's not what it's about at all. Depression is a very debilitating thing, very horrible for the people who are suffering from that. A lot of these people will show an exaggerated sense of entitlement. I should be getting paid more. You owe me this. I should be getting that promotion, not somebody else, because I'm so good. That sense of entitlement, again, is not in and of itself a conclusive factor into deciding whether somebody is going to be an active shooter someday, but it's just one of the warning signs. Poor coping skills is another one. And you know, the coping skills are huge. We all have things that life deals us sometimes, you know, a curveball. And part of just being able to cope is learning life skills. And what do we do to get through the day? What do we do to deal with disappointment? Some people just can't do it very well. And the reasons for that may be very many. Another one is if you have somebody who is constantly blaming everyone else for all their problems, not taking any responsibility for their own actions. I hear this a lot with like shoplifters, for instance, when I arrest a shoplifter. Oh, you know, I'm doing this because so-and-so isn't giving me my money, or, you know, society is treating me badly, whatever. I hear all the excuses. And it's a very common thread is that, you know, well, it's not my fault. I'm not to blame. The people that got shot should have been nicer to me. It's not my fault. And, you know, doesn't work with me. Sometimes these people are very socially awkward. Now, you know, when I was in school, looked at myself as being socially awkward, and, you know, so that, again, you know, none of these warning signs are things that are in and of themselves, but we try to look at what we call the totality of circumstance, and that's taking into account everything. If you have a whole bunch of these factors that are all falling into play, then, you know, maybe you should let somebody know that we might need to keep an eye on this individual. Again, you don't want to panic. You don't want to cause unnecessary problems. If somebody is having, you know, suffering from depression or some sort of mental illness, the last thing that they're going to want for their own mental health is to have somebody start treating them like a pariah. That's not the answer either. You know, we all come with what's called a sixth sense. And that sixth sense is that little thing that is in the back of your mind that makes the hair on the back of your neck go up. Good example. Let's say, you know, you walk into your church or something like that, and it's really crowded. There's people all over the place, and you're real focused on what you're doing, and you walk in, and you just get that weird feeling that somebody is staring at you. So what do? You look over, and you look directly at the person who's staring at you. Well, out of a crowd, how did you know that? How did you know where to look? That's that sixth sense. You know, what causes it? I don't know. I'm glad we have it. But that's what keeps us out of trouble sometimes. And sometimes, you know, we get into situations in all aspects of life where you can look and you say, you know what, something just doesn't feel right here. You know, call it the heebie-jeebies, call it whatever you want. That's what I'm telling people to kind of pay attention to. When you have the heebie-jeebies or you have this heightened awareness pop in all of a sudden, there might be a reason for it. And that are things that we need to do. Difficulty in making friends is another one. A lot of the people, and that does go back to the whole aspect of being a loner. But again, you know, like I said, these are just it's kind of some general things. So
when you know you need to keep an eye out on that person, should you leave it to a professional and bring it up to somebody to check in on that? Or is it safe to check in on that person yourself?
That's a really great question, because a lot of it has to do with how close are you to that person. If you are not close to this person, if you walk up to somebody and say, excuse me, are you planning on going in and shooting up a shopping mall? You know, that might not be the best thing. Either they'll still go through with it. They're just going to change their plans. They may speed it up.
Or a different location.
Or maybe where you are. I don't know. It really comes down to your level of comfort and your level of familiarity with that individual. We do get tips on occasion from people in the community where they will call in and say, hey, you know, so-and-so is acting really strange lately. They've been very obsessed with firearms. They're constantly talking about shooting things up. Or, boy, I wish I could go in and shoot my boss, and things like that. Now, people vent. I always take a poll when I give my presentations in public, and I always say, how many of you in this room have ever said the words, I'll kill you? And everybody sort of looks around, and nobody raises their hand. And I said, really? You've never said, touch that last piece of pizza, and I'll kill you. Touch my beer, and I'll kill you. Of course you don't mean it. Everybody has said that. I know I've said that. We mean it jokingly, but the words come out. What you have to look for when you're listening for the right words is a very distinct repetition of these. Is this becoming a little bit uncomfortably common in this person's psyche? Is this person saying a lot of things like that? Are they actually being somewhat specific? You know, like, boy, one of these days, I'm going to come in and introduce him to the business end of a shotgun. That's getting a little bit out of hand, all right? That's something where, if that's going on, I wouldn't necessarily confront that individual. You need to let somebody else know, whether it's law enforcement, whether it is your supervisor at your factory. You just need to let somebody else know. And, you know, somebody may be able to shed some light on some things, and they may say, you know, well, old Joe said that, but you know, he's going through a divorce. He's going through a bankruptcy. His life is not real good right now. Maybe what we need to be doing, and again, this goes back to the mental health issues, is if we see somebody who appears to be struggling like that, doesn't it behoove us as a society to try to help that individual before they actually reach crisis? And there are a lot of agencies and organizations now that are really trying to do that. Police departments are going through what's called CIT training, crisis intervention team training. I'm actually a coach for that, so I do help teach that. We're trying to kind of do a preemptive intervention on people before they get to that point. A lot of times, you know, we believe that the active shooter situations evolve simply because somebody has, in their mind, no outlet left. They have no way to vent. So they're just going to go out, well, you hate to say it, they're going to go out with a bang.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's something that it's constantly being analyzed as to what we can do differently to prevent this or to foresee it. If anybody could honestly say when the next one was going to occur, you could probably get rich. But in the meantime, we need to do what we can do.
Well, you had mentioned that there's no negotiating with these individuals, and that's why you have professionals during the time of crisis. Any idea what possibly is going through their head other than society owes me?
I don't think anybody knows. Obviously, you can't ask the people that did the shooting. But in some cases, when they do the investigations post-shooting, they'll find manifestos, things on people's computers. Most people, especially when they know that they're going to die doing this and that this is a suicide mission, they, like I said, they don't care whether they live or not. They have no intention of living. But most people want to have the last word. That's just like human nature. People like to have the last word. So their last word is generally going to be a manifesto, a journal. You know, I've seen journals from people who've done stuff. A lot of times it's their chance to say, this is why I did this. And if we don't pay attention to those journals, we're really doing a disservice to ourselves. The journals can tell you a lot, even if they don't say it directly. You can read some of these journals or the manifestos. And people, you know, you'll see them referred to on the news as like a rambling manifesto. Well, the word rambling is a very strong word in that, because what they're really saying is that there's not a lot of logic or connectivity to their thinking pattern, which obviously points to something. It points to mental illness. Some cases you'll have the religious fanaticism, you know, the terrorist cells that are, you know, we've been told now. Homeland Security, we've seen an act of it just recently, within the last month. You know, now are they acting on behalf of the various terrorist organizations? Who knows? Who knows? But you better pay attention to it. So, you know, what goes through the psyche? I don't know. You know, the best thing I can relate to is, you know, these are like kamikaze pilots from the old World War II kamikaze pilots. They're going to go out. They have their mission. They're not going to live through it. Do as much damage as you can. It's a scary thing to think about. It really is.
So we talked about the signs, where it can happen. Let's say it does happen. What's your first step as a person who's stuck in that situation?
Well, you know, heaven forbid anybody ends up in that situation. There's three basic concepts that we deal with when we're talking about active shooter. And none of, like I said, none of this is rocket science. This is all basic human nature. But we're going to lay it out there. And it's the three concepts are very simply run, hide, and fight. Those are your options when presented with a situation that is going to be a life and death situation. It's easy to say, well, gee, I'm going to run if somebody comes into my office. But, you know, for those of you out there listening right now, take a look around your office. Where are you going to run to? You know, in this studio right now, we have one door. If a person comes in that door and wants to start shooting, where are you going to go? You aren't going to go through the little windows in here. For those of you who are working in cubicles and somebody walks in and starts shooting, where are you going to run? You need to think about this. Just take 2 minutes. Even do it right now, right while you're listening to this broadcast. Look around you. Where will you go? Figure out what the most likely location that somebody is going to come through the whatever door. If you have one door that's in the room that you're in, well, that's the door they're coming through. Are you going to try to get it out of a window if it's feasibly possible? Obviously, if you're on the 10th floor of a building, that's not too feasible. But you need to have a plan, and you need to just keep it in the back of your mind at all times. When we were all young and people would say, well, you know, your parents would tell you, don't walk through a dark parking ramp by yourself. Or if you do, for, you know, we used to tell ladies, keep keys in your hand and things like that. There's a lot of planning. So, you know, here's a question for you. And this is what this will kind of come to that point. In the last 50 years, Terry, how many kids have died in school fires?
School fires?
School fires.
I don't know, maybe 10?
Zero. And why? Why is that? Well, obviously, when we were all in school, what did we do? 2-3 times a year, fire drills. You know, when I was really young, we still ended up doing these, you know, nuclear blast drills, which were always a bit comical because hiding under your desk during a nuclear blast isn't going to do much. But the fire drills, they work. They work. Kids know what to do. You know, you will exit in an orderly fashion. You will go down this staircase. That's a plan. And that's what businesses need to be doing. Since I started doing these presentations, I'm getting called by a lot of different businesses to come out. You know, would you mind looking at our facility? Could you give us some tips? We're happy to do that, but please give me, you know, a good month and a half, 2 months advance notice. I book up rather quickly. But getting back to the run, hide, and fight, you know, you need an escape plan. Just as if it's a fire, where do you think you're going to go? Now, in the absence of being able to escape, because a lot of people can't, there's no way out, you need to figure out a place to hide. And it could be something as simple as shut the lights off in your office. Lock that door if it locks. Somebody coming into a building, unless they happen to be actually an employee who was in there, if it's just a random person who's deciding that that's the day they want to end their life and take as many people with them as possible, are going to go walking through that building and they're going to look for quick, easy avenues of being able to kill people and shoot people. Because they know from the time that they walk in there and that first shot is fired, the clock is running. Police are going to be notified. Everyone is going to be scrambling. Perhaps you have a citizen who's armed, legally armed, carrying concealed carry or whatever. Are they going to put a stop to it? You just plain don't know. You need to be able to look at something and say, where am I going to hide? You know, maybe you have like a favorite metal cabinet that you can crawl into. Leave a space in there, you know, where you don't fill it up with junk, that you can maybe crawl into. Because the people, unless they're looking for specific individuals, are going to go for the easiest opportunities. If they can force their way into your office, if they even bother to try, they're going to kind of glance around quick and try to move on to the next person. You know, so that's where the hide comes in. But just basically sitting there and hoping it's not going to happen is not hiding. Fight. Now, fighting is something that a lot of us look at it and say, you know, gee, I'm elderly, I'm infirm, whatever, and I just can't fight. And to that, I say, you are wrong. Every human being has a way, in some way, shape, or form, that they can fight. If you look around the office that we're in here, and again, for those of you listening, take a second and look at your desk or look at the stuff on your shelves. What possible weapons? Yeah, Terry's picking up a microphone stand right now. Yeah, that's got some weight to it. Everything you have in there, pencils, pens, a rolled up magazine. You can stab somebody with a rolled up magazine. Now everybody's going to go home tonight and they're going to roll up their Time magazines. Roll them up really, really tight and hold them like you were using it to stab somebody.
Or shield yourself.
Yeah. But no matter what you do, this is the two most important factors in everything that we are talking about now. The plan. We talked about the planning. You have to have a preconceived plan on what you hope you might be able to do in this given situation. The other thing is going to be mental discipline. You have to have that mental discipline. You have to tell yourself, I am going to survive this. I am going to do whatever it takes to survive. And you have to believe that. That is the no-lose mentality. Police officers, soldiers, firefighters, ambulance people, all these emergency responders, when we go out, we know that we're running towards the fire or towards the gunshots. When I run into a building as a police officer where there's a shooting going on, I know that I might be killed. I know that my life is at risk, but I'm not going to walk in there and say, gosh, I sure hope I don't get killed today. I have to focus on my job. I'm going to focus on taking down that individual, preventing loss of life. But first and foremost, I'm coming out of there alive. I have a wife and two children. I have a family, just like everybody else out there. I'm going to go home and see my family. I will not let this person rob my family from me. That is my mentality about this. And obviously, yes, I cannot prevent everything in life. But I'm sure not going to go down without a fight. So if you happen to be trapped in your cubicle, trapped in a room, and you think you have nothing to fight with, you have fingernails, you have hands. Many people in the history of the world have been beaten to death by hands. All right? It sounds brutal and you don't think you can do it, but here are your options. If you don't, you're dead. It's that simple. You will not negotiate with these people. They are not interested in negotiating because they don't plan on living through this for the most part. They just want to kill as many people as possible. And this is a very terrifying subject. When I give the presentations, a lot of people, I kind of watch the looks on people's faces. And by the time they're done, I see the gears are working in their brain. And they're thinking, oh my goodness, this is such a bleak topic. But folks, things have changed in our society. And it's not just in the United States. It's in the world. Look what we have now. We're dealing with rogue cells, lone wolf cells for terrorism. This isn't going to go away. This isn't going to go away anytime soon. We can still go on with our lives. We can still enjoy our lives. And I strongly encourage that. Never let the thought of terrorism or active shooter or things like that deprive you of a wonderful life. But just keep it in the back of your mind. You need to do things. You need to think about running. You need to think about hiding. You need to think about fighting.
Sometimes when you see this happen in one area, another one will quickly soon happen thereafter. I'm guessing you would call those copycat events. And I'm guessing everybody should be a little bit more aware of their surroundings when there's a mass attack or shooting.
Yeah, you know, FBI statistics and Homeland Security statistics tend to show that there, you can generally plan that at some point there's going to be a copycat or an attempt within 72 hours. A lot of these people are not very original in their thinking, but what they do is they look at the damage, the media hype, and the notoriety that has been left after a shooting or an incident. And that's what triggers them. And they'll be saying to themselves, wow, that person has a lot of attention drawn to them now. That's the way I want to go out. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we kind of look at it. I mean, I don't know that Columbine was the first time there was ever a shooting in a school. I really don't think it was. I think if I dug around, I could find something. But it was the first on that scale. Well, then now, school shootings, sadly, are almost commonplace. And what are they doing? Media hype comes in. They broadcast everything. And, you know, for the next month or 2 months, it's a big sensational display of what this person accomplished in that shooting. If you don't think that feeds into somebody who is already suffering from perhaps mental illness or revenge or whatever is going through their mind, they're looking at that and saying, wow, I can do better than that. And they try to one-up the next person. And that's where it really becomes scary. Like when I was young, I graduated from Winona Senior High here back in 1982. I'm a local. And, you know, we didn't have school guards, school security back then. We had a wonderful person named Eddie Spencer. And Eddie was the disciplinarian. And I just remember him very fondly. But that's what we were dealing with back then. And now, you know, we have an officer in the high school here. And that's very commonplace in high schools around America. Many high schools in the bigger cities, they have metal detectors. See-through bags. Students are not allowed to bring things into the building. Thankfully, in Winona, we have not had a shooting. I hope we never have a shooting. I'd like to see no more shootings anywhere in the country ever again. But that's not very realistic thinking. But I'll tell you what, we plan. We as law enforcement, we train. We train in active shooter situations. We go through a lot of the schools. I'm not going to go into the details of what we do while we're in there. But suffice to say, we, along with other jurisdictions, since we're not a very big department ourselves, you know, we get together with Winona County Sheriff's Department, Goodview Police Department, Lewiston, St. Charles, anybody. All police officers across the country should be or currently are being trained in active shooter scenarios. I know in Winona, I've probably been in most of the schools, and we usually go in, you know, with the blessing of the school or the school board. We'll go in on a day off or a holiday or a weekend when nobody else is around, and we'll basically reconnoiter the school. You know, we know where the little nooks and crannies are, places where somebody could hide. We familiarize ourselves with that. Those of you that are at work that are listening to this right now, maybe you need to familiarize yourself with your business. I've had a lot of businesses call me and say, would you come out? Could we give you the floor plans of our factory so that if we have an active shooter that your people know where everything is? You know, one thing we probably could talk about here is what is going to happen to you as the individual if an active shooter situation happens? And I can tell you that because it's not a tactical thing or anything like that. Obviously, if a shooting starts, we're coming in. We have a job to do. Our job is to stop that shooter. That is the sole focus of those officers that are going to come through that door. It's not a mission that is going to be an easy mission. It's not a mission that is always very sympathetic to people that are wounded. When you're going into a situation like that, do not expect that the police officers can stop and tend to all the wounded along the way. That is not their function. We need to stop the carnage before we can start dealing with the wounded. As the officers go through and we clear various areas, then obviously emergency personnel are going to be coming in behind, and that they will be tending to the wounded. One of the things that I end up telling people, and this is very, very difficult for a lot of people to hear, but it's a fact. People freeze during crisis situations. If you have somebody, I'm sorry if it's your best friend, doesn't matter. If that person is freezing up, panicking, and not running out of the building with you, not doing anything to try to hide, not doing anything, leave them. because it is not going to do you any good to die with them. And again, I know that sounds incredibly harsh, but that's the harsh reality of what we're dealing with in an active shooter situation. You sitting there and dying isn't going to help. It's not going to help anything. So you need to leave them. The officers, when they come through, are going to be heavily armed. The officers are coming through. We're human beings. We are going to be very nervous because we don't know who the active shooter is. If it's an employee, if it's in a school, let's say there was an active shooter situation at the high school. You have what? 400 kids, 400 students in the high school, 500? Which one is the shooter? They all look the same when they're running and screaming. So we don't know who the shooter is. We may grab people. We will try to get direction from people. We will say, hey, who? What are we looking for? Tell us what the person is wearing. As much as you can give us. We need you to give us that information as we're going through. Because we want to stop the shooter as fast as possible. Unfortunately, we may not always be very polite about the way we ask. That's life. We have a very, very difficult job to do. Understand that since we don't know who you are, how do we know that you're not the shooter who decided he wants to survive now and is going to try to sneak out of the building along with the rest of the victims that he hasn't killed yet? You're going to be taken out. You'll probably, as you see in a lot of the news footage, people are coming out of buildings. Their hands are up. They're being marched out under armed guard because we still don't know who the shooter is in many cases. Was there a second shooter? We may have taken out the first shooter. The first shooter may have committed suicide. Is there a second? Is there a third? We have to always assume the worst. And until we can sort it out and figure out that it is truly safe and secure, the police are going to come in and do what they have to do. Contrary to popular belief, you know, the cops aren't out there just to kill everybody. And I know that most people in society appreciate, value their police departments, their police officers, and understand that it's a very, very tough job. Police are not trained to shoot guns out of people's hands or wing them like they do in a cowboy western. That is unrealistic. We are there to stop the threat, period. It's not a pleasant thing. It's a very brutal business. But this is a very brutal situation. An active shooter is the worst situation I can imagine as a police officer to either enter into or to be in as a citizen. You know, it's certainly something that, again, we pray it never happens, but it does.
Let's say you survive a situation like this. What happens afterwards?
What happens afterwards is probably more important than what actually happened during the shooting. And I know that sounds a little weird, but it goes back to psychological conditioning. Any trauma that anybody survives, and we're seeing this right now with all our, you know, wonderful men and women coming back from service in the military. We're dealing with PTSD. We're dealing with a lot of trauma issues. And that can happen just as easily with any trauma. But can you imagine the trauma that's going to be involved with an active shooter situation? Businesses, society, communities in general have to band together here because it's not just the problem of the company who went through the shooting. If you think about the ripple effect of the trauma that's going to hit this, you survive the shooting, you go home from your day at work, this is going through your mind. This will never leave you for the rest of your life. You will see that going over and over in your mind. You're going to take that home. Your personality will have changed. You're going to go home and take that to your family. Your family is going to undergo the stress. Not the same degree, but a stress nevertheless. All your relatives. Your workplace is now going to change. You're going to go in and you're going to look at your fellow people. You're going to look at them differently because you realize that the potential for something dark in any human being is present. That's a scary thing. So after a shooting, you need to have professional psychological counseling. You need to have that made available to you. I always stress to business owners, have this stuff planned for. Crisis manuals are things that people talk about, but they don't do. If I go into a factory, I can see a book and probably anybody's shelf that has to do with material data. And that's what happens if you splash this liquid in your eye or get it on your hand. Everybody has reams of this material sitting around. But nobody wants to put together a manual. What happens if there's an active shooter? Because what happens if the person, one of the people who were shot in this active shooter, was the person who was supposed to be the crisis planner? They had the big plan. What you need to do, and all businesses need to do this, all organizations, you need to have a crisis manual that any employee, anybody could find. If it's laying on the ground, pick it up. Page one, this is what you do in case of fire. This is what you do in case of an accident. This is who you call, what you do in case of an active shooter. And you have the phone numbers listed there in big letters, big numbers. This is the person you contact. After the event, these are the psychologists in the area who are trained to deal with trauma and PTSD. Not all psychologists or counselors specialize in those fields. You have to have somebody that knows what they're doing. Have these people available to you, whether you have their business card on them or whatever. Make sure you know how to get a hold of these people. It's that important. Obviously, people like, you know, ambulance, fire, all these EMS people are going to be there. Hospital would be put on notification. They're going to be on standby to receive the wounded. But what about the people that are psychologically wounded? That is a wound that may never heal, but it can be managed. And that's what's important about it. That management has to come with the pre-planning as well. So again, I encourage people that are listening, create a crisis plan, create a crisis manual. Have something ready that you can call on at a moment's notice. You can open it up and say, here's who I need to be calling. Because when panic sets in, you're not going to be thinking clearly. You're not going to have time to go and let's look up a phone book or let's go on the internet right now and see what counselors in the area handle PTSD or trauma. So again, planning.
This might seem like an odd question, but there have been technological advancements in order to get a hold of the police department. There's been a lot of talk about being able to text 911 or how to get a hold of the police in a situation like that. What would be your recommendation if you're the person and you have means of reaching out in the moment?
I would strongly not recommend the texting part of it. I don't know that our dispatchers have the capability of receiving the 911 text yet. In some cases, if you are in like, you know, holed up in a room or something and you're trying to stay quiet and you're unable to call out or speak, you can try that. Try texting somebody. But the prevalence of cell phones in society make it that the calls will start coming in. They'll flood in with a matter of seconds. Stay on the phone. Stay on the phone with dispatchers when something is happening. We need to ask questions. They will keep you on the phone generally. If you're in there and you can give us current information, tell us what floor they're on of the building. Tell us what end of the building they're on. Tell us information. How many do you think there are? What type of guns are they carrying? Not specific make models and stuff like that, but are they carrying shotguns? Do they have pistols? Do you think there's a bomb involved? The more information you can give law enforcement and EMS, the better it's going to be, the better we can plan our response. From the time that we activate and start moving towards that area, every police officer, every firefighter, every EMS personnel is going to be going through their head playing the what-if game. What if I get there and this happens? What should I do? That's part of our training. We're trained to do things like this. You're dealing with professionals, but the situation is not a textbook. There is no such thing as a textbook shooting. You know, it's a very dynamic situation, changing rapidly, and we're going to have to adapt, but we can sure use your help on the other end. I always tell people to, if nothing else, try to be excellent witnesses. Be able to give us details. If you're just screaming into the phone, hey, somebody is shooting in the senior high, that's not going to help us a lot. We need you to calm down a little bit, and I realize that when somebody says calm down during a shooting, that's a little laughable, but We need you to be able to give us the information so that we can more efficiently and effectively neutralize the situation and then deal with the ramifications afterwards.
Is there anything we haven't gone over? Other pertinent information to know?
Not really, other than just, you know, a lot of people with your cell phones have a one push button capability of dialing 911. Check your cell phones out and make sure that you have that. And again, plan. Plan, plan, plan. Have that mindset, the if this happens, I am going to survive. But you will only survive by having a plan. And that's the key thing. Again, we don't want to look at all of our fellow men that, or ladies out there, as everybody's a potential shooter. But the sad reality is it could be anybody. You just don't know. And it's not even necessarily shooting. There's been many instances of people going through workplaces stabbing people.
Oh, yeah.
Or pipe bombs, things like that. Very scary. I mean, death and destruction come in a lot of different forms. It's just a matter of what they want to do, how fast they want to do it, and how much destruction they want to do in the meantime.
Well, thanks so much for coming in and giving us your presentation. We appreciate your time.
Well, again, thank you so much for having me here today, Terry. And, you know, for the listening audience, you know, don't panic about the stuff. Again, don't let it darken your day. Just keep this in the back of your head. And again, plan.
Thanks again to Officer Eric Mueller from the Winona Police Department for sharing with us his presentation, Active Shooter. Officer Mueller can be reached at 507-457-6302. Again, 507-457-6302. I'm Terry Tensett, and you've been listening to Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.